WBOI Presents In Session is a series where we'll hear from teachers, educators, and experts on all sorts of topics, sharing their lessons in the WBOI studios. As part of our commitment to lifelong learning, In Session gives us an opportunity to partner with those who have something to teach us. During this episode, we'll hear from Tom Castaldi, host of On the Heritage Trail and 89.1 WBOI, on the topic of history. Thank you for listening. Welcome to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. We made it. This episode marks the beginning of WBOI Presents In Session, Season 2. And we're going to be starting now with a topic that I've been wanting to hit for a while. Season 1 of In Session focused mostly on words and writing. We had episodes on etymology, journalism, literature, and media literacy. We also covered political science and traditional science with an episode on astronomy. But when Season 1 wrapped, I realized that one of my favorite topics hadn't been part of it. History. I loved history classes in every level of school. If we were going back in time, I was there for it. Here at WBOI, we have an expert on local history right here in the building. And today he joins me in the studio. Tom Castaldi, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ben.
Before we go any further, let's start with some of your own history. How long have you been inviting listeners to join you on the Heritage Trail, and how did that journey start?
Well, it's been a wonderful journey for me. And next year, I'll mark my 25th anniversary of doing episodes here on first WBNI and then WBOI. I happened to be looking at a newsletter from back in 1995 called Modulations. And it announced my very first effort, which were called Canal Notes. And I was trying to make a little play on canal boats, as it were. But they began August the 7th, 1995. They aired on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Then on the Heritage Trail, the earliest I can find is something like April of 2001. It was picked up to replace Canal Notes because the then station manager, Bruce Haynes, was watching what was happening with our bicentennial celebration back in 1994, and he thought we should have something that related to that a little bit. So it turned out that in placing one of the legacies of the bicentennial, which was the Heritage Trail, we had produced a bicentennial guide. So the research was all done, and it was a jumping off place for me to begin the series. It probably started in 2004 with On the Heritage Trail.
This is WBOI Presents In Session. Our guest instructor is Tom Castaldi, and this episode is History, Lesson 1. Working in a newsroom for the last couple years, it's been hard to miss the activity going on downtown with riverfront development. If you go back in time to before there was an urban center or even a fort or a settlement or a canal, there were still rivers. So yes, our look at history of the downtown riverfront does begin with the end of an ice age.
That's right. 14,000 years ago or so, we were experiencing a move from global cooling to global warming. And this area, I've heard some people say that the ice was as thick as a mile deep in these parts. So when that started to melt and to recede, it created what's called moraines or little ridges here and there in the topography, in the geography. And one of the main effects of that was that up until then, the waterways of what we now know as the St. Mary's and the St. Joseph Rivers were joining with what's called the Little Wabash or the Little River, and they were flowing directly to the southwest into what we know as the Wabash system. After these moraines started taking place, all of a sudden these rivers changed their courses and the St. Mary's and the St. Joseph's developed the Maumee River. So when you look at all the rivers, it's curious that we have rivers running in every direction in our county. We have the St. Mary's flowing to the north, the St. Joseph flowing south, the Maumee to the east, and lo and behold, through the other drainages, we have the Little Wabash to the Wabash River flowing west.
So we've looked at the rivers flowing through, into, and around Fort Wayne, so that covers what they are. But now we want to look at what they're called. Considering American history and the fact that two of the four rivers you just mentioned are named after saints, I'm assuming there are religious missionaries in this history somewhere.
You know, the History Center some years ago did some research on that question, although a lot of speculation, I must say, because the director at the time, Don Werling, was studying the Jesuit relations and found that there was a Father Henri Nouvel who had arrived here on December 7th. The year was 1675. He had come down through the Great Lakes from St. Ignatius and Lake Erie area, came upon a fine river. The Maumee River is the longest of the rivers of any of the Great Lakes. That's probably the river that the story was based on. And Father Nouvel came up the river, and as he goes, he came up, he got to where we know today as the Auglaize River in Defiance, and made a wrong turn going up the Auglaize, had to backtrack. All this is recorded in the relations. And it turned out that that was December 7, 1675. It was the eve of the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, typical of the area. Oftentimes these rivers, these places were named for a particular religious event, and hence the St. Mary's and the St. Joseph were dubbed. Now, whether that's factual, we don't know. It's the best story I've ever heard yet up to now.
And as early as we have recorded record of settlers and others coming into this area, there were many that had a vision for what has been called and would have been called then the Northwest Territory, what it could be. What did that vision look like?
Well, one historian has recorded that La Salle had a vision to create a wilderness empire that would arc over the Great Lakes and the Mississippi River, which later would become the Northwest Territory. But it was to reach their then French main ports, Quebec to the north and New Orleans to the south. And the idea would be that it would serve as military and trade strongholds along the way. Coming up from New Orleans, St. Louis was one of the strongholds or one of the trading centers of importance. And coming up the Ohio River into the Wabash, you had Vincennes, and in Weatenon, which is today Lafayette, and then Kikianga, which is here in Fort Wayne, on up to Detroit, then to Quebec. There's also another story I ran into where LaSalle had noticed that there was this portage where after the glacier action had carved out the Wabash Valley, it left this high subcontinental divide that we have here. That's where the French had a name for these land barriers between all waterway routes, which was what occurs right here in Allen County. They could go from New Orleans to Quebec with only having to get out of their boats at one place, one time, and that was here on the high ground, which they called a portage. We hacked her down to portage. That was an area he felt needed to be protected. This one historian knew that the Miami, of course, LaSalle's talking from up on Lake Michigan, up in that area, and he knew that the Miami were always being pestered by the Iroquois. And this particular historian thought that it would be a good idea to encourage the Miami to settle in this area. Whether that's true to Miami history, I'm not sure. But I think the Miami were here long before anybody else was. It was always a treasured geographical place in an otherwise wilderness. One quick thought, Ben, for listeners who don't know, LaSalle was a major historical character in these parts, representing the French, and had explored much of this part of the country into the Mississippi River. Whether or not he traveled specifically through our county has always been a question. Some people argue he had, some disagree.
So you mentioned bigger names, I guess, in the historical context, bigger players like LaSalle and Little Turtle. Who were some of the lesser known players in the early history of our rivers in our area?
I always found it interesting that Vincennes, who later had a town named for him and his son, were active here. There was a Jesuit priest by the name of Father Pierre Bonnecamp, who was studying the waters of this area for the University of Quebec. There was also the battle between the French and the British fighting for control of the fur trade in here in our area. And I don't know, there was other people like Hamilton.
I am not throwing away my shot.
And this is where we should clarify, no, not that Hamilton. Lin-Manuel Miranda has single-handedly catapulted Alexander Hamilton back into the list of the top five most famous founding fathers. That is not the Hamilton we are talking about.
No, no, this is Lieutenant Governor Henry Hamilton. And he was on his way to Vincennes, if I bring that name up again, with his army coming out of Detroit to go down there and settle things because the French population down there was becoming more and more favorable to the American cause. George Rogers Clark making his move. And but significant for us was that Hamilton found this a place in which he could store his materiel for his return trip with these troops. Later, there was a small contingent of soldiers led by La Bombe, who decided that he'd like to get his hands on that material and came up the Wabash from the southwest and raided the fort at Fort Wayne and did a lot of ravaging and pillaging and what have you. And here again, it's another famous name for where the Miami come in again, as La Bombe retreated and camped overnight on his return back to the southwest. A Little Turtle with a group of his warriors came up and annihilated him. Some very colorful history through these parts. There's another story about Hamilton when he was coming through the Portage, which was then known as the Great Marsh, the swamp. It was a time of drought, and the boats that they were trying to cross the Portage would be grounded. There was just not enough room or not enough depth of water to float their boats. So what they did is they hesitated for a while the beaver in the area, which was one of the retractions for why people were coming through here anyway for the beaver fur trade. The beaver repair their dams, and it raised the water, and then Hamilton tore the dams down, and the boats floated through. The upshot of that was that the Miami knew that trick as well, and the Miami and the Brits after that always honored the beaver in that area, protected them.
Coinciding with a lot of what we've just been talking about is events leading up to and the actual fighting of the American Revolution, our winning it, and events from there, which brings in a couple major players, both named George, King George III, and our first president, George Washington. What were some of their concerns about our area?
Well, it's interesting that as early as 1763, King George was forbidding colonists to establish settlements west of what we knew as what we know as the Appalachian Range. After the Revolution was won by the Americans, the Americans were trying to encourage movement to the west. The Northwest Territory was established in 1787, and George Washington was facing the problems with immigration, moving people into these areas. And he was finding that the people who were coming in by boat on the Ohio River found it more convenient just to float on by and on to the Mississippi and out of the Northwest Territory down into what was known then as the Spanish-held New Orleans area. There was a need for military routes, the ways to get materiel moved in and out of Northwest wilderness. Sparks, who was a biographer of Washington, he said there were whispers of settlers in this area who were considering seceding from the Union. Washington had to take control over this area. He had sent three armies over the years. Obviously, the indigenous people were protecting their lands here. And he sent an army led by St. Clair, who was stopped by Little Turtle, and a second army led by Harmer, who came up into this area. And once again, the Miami and Little Turtle's people stopped him. Then finally, of course, Wayne was sent. And when I say they were sent, they typically came out of the Cincinnati area and would come up approximately the Ohio-Indiana line, as it were. Maybe that's a little too specific, but that would be generally how it would be viewed. And then, of course, Little Turtle had a son-in-law by the name of William Wells. He would move into the Cincinnati area where these armies were located and could find out what the mood was, what people were actually getting plans for how these armies were going to take on the area up here, Kikianga, now Fort Wayne. So he advised Little Turtle, he says, I don't know about this Anthony Wayne. He's a man who never sleeps. All of a sudden, Little Turtle starts getting the bad raps from Blue Jacket, for example, and actually is calling him a coward for not wanting to take Wayne on. And of course, Wayne came up and over at Fallen Timbers was victorious and marched back to the Three Rivers and established Fort Wayne.
So once Wayne had, for lack of a better phrase, finished his work, then we start seeing a shift in focus to the changing and construction of new waterways.
Yeah, the glacier is still in play here because what it left was what we now know, of course, is Lake Erie. But back in the day, that actually started out the Maysville Road here in the east side of Fort Wayne. That's where the Lake Erie at one time reached. And then it left what was known as the Black Swamp when there was just no way anybody really wanted to go in and out of that place because it was just people would go in and come back terrified or maybe not come back at all. It depends on the stories you're hearing. And then on the west side of Fort Wayne, we have what we've been talking about, the Portage. And it too had the swamp and the water. It just made a nasty area to try to get through before the late 1800s when it was actually drained and the Little River was channeled. So in 1832, the groundbreaking took place for the Wabash Erie Canal. By 1835, it had been completed over to Huntington, and by 1843 it had reached Lafayette, and then it had by then had made its way through that black swamp to Toledo. Then finally the canal reached the Ohio River in 1853. But the significance of that is that was finally there was a way to get through that black swamp and across the Portage, and you had an all waterway route through the Great Lakes to the Ohio River. They had a kind of a grand opening at where Sweeney Park stands today. And the message that we got from Dwight Clinton, the father of the Erie Canal, who had finished the Erie Canal in 1825, said, congratulations, you have shown my way for my canal through to the Ohio River and to the Mississippi by virtue of having completed the Wabash Erie Canal. Because the way was shown for the canal, later roads followed the pathway, as did railroads, as did interurbans, and it was this transportation that made possible for people to come to this area, for industry to decide to settle. Finally, in this day, we're at a point where we can really celebrate all of that success of economic development for people sharing one another's gifts with our downtown development that's taken place in Fort Wayne today.
Tom, thank you so much for being a part of Season 2 of WBOI Presents In Session, and thank you for taking us on an extended journey on the Heritage Trail.
Thank you, Ben. It's been a pleasure traveling with you today.
And thank you for listening to WBOI Presents In Session. You can find more episodes of WBOI Presents In Session at WBOI.org. And while you're there, you can find the very latest from the WBOI news team and stay up to date on content we produce year-round. Our theme music is by Noah Campodonico. Our sound effects are by John Dawkins. Our web producer is Loyal Vandenberg. Additional audio comes from Caleb Meyer. Thank you for listening.